I want to read to you from another source above top secret, the Roswell incident. One of the most contentious aspects of the UFO enigma is the allegation that a number of flying saucers have actually crash-landed and been removed by the military in great secrecy. The claim has been generally dismissed for lack of proof, yet the evidence is compelling. Former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer Leonard Stringfield, for example, has now collected at least 40 such accounts, some of them from first-hand witnesses. One incident that now seems indisputable in the sense that anomalous wreckage was recovered occurred within a few days of the United Airlines sighting. And they just talked about the United Airlines sighting in this book. A few days after this incident, now seems indisputable and has been the subject of one of the most thoroughly documented investigations on record. On the evening of July 2nd, 1947, a bright, disc-shaped object was seen flying over Roswell, New Mexico, headed northwest. The following day, widely scattered wreckage was discovered about 75 miles northwest of Roswell by a local ranch manager, William Brazell, together with his son and daughter. The authorities were eventually alerted, and a quantity of wreckage was recovered by Major Jesse Marcel. Now, remember that name. He'll, under pressure of government, will tell the party line about a weather balloon, but then will later change his story and tell the truth. The authorities were eventually alerted, and the quantity of wreckage was recovered by Major Jesse Marcel, a staff intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group Intelligence Office at the Army Air Force bases at Roswell Field, together with a counterintelligence corps officer. Once the officers had returned to the Roswell base, an official press statement was released, authorized by Colonel William Blanchard, confirming that wreckage of a flying disc had been recovered. Major Jesse Marcel was ordered to load the debris on a B-29 and fly it to Wright Field, now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at Dayton, Ohio, for examination. I have people listening up in Ohio, and I'd like to know what you have to say up there about Wright Field in relation to this. On arrival at an intermediate stop at Carswell Army Air Force's base, Fort Worth, Texas, headquarters of the 8th Air Force, General Roger Ramey took charge and ordered Marcel and others on the plane not to talk to reporters. A second press statement was issued, which stated that the wreckage was nothing more than the remains of a weather balloon and its attached tinfoil radar tap target. And this was prominently displayed at the press conference. Meanwhile, the real wreckage arrived at Wright Field under armed guard. Marcel returned to Roswell, and Brazell was held incommunicado for nearly a week while the crash site was stripped of every scrap of debris. A news leak by a press wire from Albuquerque describing this fantastic story was interrupted, and the radio station in question and another were warned not to continue the broadcast. Quote, "Attention, Albuquerque. Cease transmission. Repeat, cease transmission. National security item. Do not transmit. Stand by." The unidentified wreckage, scattered over an area three-quarters of a mile long by several hundred feet wide, consisted of various types of material, which, according to Major Marcel, was like nothing he had seen before or since. Quote, there was all kinds of stuff, small beams about three-eighths or a half-inch square, with some sort of hieroglyphics on them that nobody could decipher. These looked something like balsa wood and were of about the same weight, except that they were not wood at all. They were very hard, although flexible, and would not burn. There was a great deal of unusual parchment-like substance, which was brown in color and extremely strong, and a great number of small pieces of a metal like tinfoil, except that it wasn't tinfoil. Lake Elsinore called this in last night, saying, last Friday night, Saturday morning, I heard a talk show on an Albuquerque radio station, and a guy called in and said that in 1948 he was on leave from the Army and he went into a bar. There was an old man sitting at the bar with a piece of foil-like metal. He was betting everyone in the bar that they couldn't bend, cut, scratch, or in any other way make a mark on it. People tried everything, including some kind of a blowtorch. He never lost a bet. No one was able to affect the metal in any way, and the guy sounded very believable to me. Keep reporting to me, folks. Marcel added that one piece of metal foil, 2 feet long and a foot wide, was so durable that it could not be dented with a sledgehammer despite its being incredibly light. Marcel was absolutely convinced that the material had nothing to do with a weather balloon or radar target. His testimony cannot be dismissed owing to his background in aviation. He served as bombardier, waist gunner, and pilot, logged 468 hours of combat flying in B-24 aircraft, and was awarded 5 air medals for shooting down enemy aircraft in World War II. Toward the end of the war, he was attached to the 509th Bomb Wing, an elite military group for which all those involved required high security clearances. Following the Roswell incident, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and assigned to a special weapons program that specialized in analyzing air samples to discover if the Russians had detonated their first nuclear bomb. Were bodies recovered? At that point, I will take up in about 14 minutes, depending on how you work the telephone. So talk to me now. Thank God that phone's over. They must have picked up music from a UFO today. Albany, New York. Tell Dr. Scott we're listening on 610. We love it. 1610, that is. We just love it. Looks like Toon Poon, I'm not sure, and I hope you'll call back and correct me. Trinidad, British West Indies. 1610 coming in clear. I enjoy your teaching. Been listening for about 2 months now. Keep up the great work. Praise the Lord. Why don't you become the first King's House in Trinidad? We had one in Venezuela last night. All a King's House commits to do is try to watch or listen at least once a week and support in some manner. Galatians 6 says, if you've been taught in the Word, share materially with the one that taught you. In so doing, you release the Holy Spirit to reap a harvest of life eternal for you. I'm looking for King's Houses in every country. Miami, Florida. You may say, well, I got Caribbean money. Well, fine. The tithe is the Lord's if you only make 10 cents a week. The penny's the Lord's. Miami, Florida. My older brother was involved with the entire manned spaceflight program. He's a computer genius. He told me that with every flight we sent up, it was met by a UFO. On one occasion, our computers were confused with the UFO and locked on it for about 1.5 hours and lost our ship temporarily. I was personally listening to a live broadcast between our flight commander and ground control when the commander said, "Oh my God, there's a UFO." The news cut out, and this was never repeated. Another reports of UFOs. New Haven, Connecticut. Would you like to receive photo evidence in the southern Connecticut area? The UFOs are circular and triangular in shape. Photographs on both land and in the air. They're being chased, followed, or escorted by unmarked black helicopters. And these helicopters have followed me home in a harassing manner. I have photos of these helicopters. Yeah, I want some. Yeah, please send the pictures. In Orange Park, Florida, I'd like to hear more about UFOs. It was because of the book in the 70s, "Is God an Ancient Astronaut?" that I lost my faith. I'd like to hear what a man of God says about UFOs. As long as he's the longest lasting and most powerful ancient astronaut, that wouldn't affect my faith at all. Quit trying to create a God of your own imagination. Jesus said, "You've seen me, you've seen the Father." I lost my faith, became an agnostic in university, came back through a study of the resurrection. Not just the resurrection, but because the one who made the claims about himself that Jesus made about himself, including that he would die and rise again, was the one who rose, got my attention. And those claims are my starting point for a definition of God. And the essence of godness is power. I don't care what they tell you. God is love, but love is not God. God is God because he's most powerful. It does not bother me whether he evolved, always was. Those are man's projections of the nature of God that the New Testament disciples never even had to think about. It wouldn't matter to me if God evolved, as long as he is now revealed to be the kind of God he is, which is the kind of God that I'm glad he is, and he has supreme power. I'm satisfied. I don't care how he got to where he got. I ain't going to live through the development phase. Eternity to me, I have no time, so I'm sure I'm going to have to go back in it. I don't care if God and the devil arm wrestled, mud wrestled, or shot it out at high noon. God won. Quit worrying about some of these metaphysical subjects. I've been reading for the last 2 weeks. I'm about ready to come out with it on the Black Virgin in ecclesiastical and mythical history. The clerics are just scared to death of the Black Virgins. And they exist. In sight of miracles. And the Black Virgin is at the root of much of the Priori di Sion, the secret society that is so much a part of the history of the Merovingians. And the story of Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And that's part of that age-old contest between the male and the female image of supremacy. Now, believe you me, I'm glad that this Black Virgin is not all-powerful. There's a lot of silly ideas in Christianity. like the one that pervaded the South for years, that black skin is the mark of Cain. I'm sorry, the opposite is what archaeology and history would indicate. The mark of Cain was white skin. There's a lot of idiot ideas running around. That make void the Word of God because they are traditions. God breathed the spatial quality into Adam and Eve. They carried in their genes all the traits of their descendants. The Celtic cauldron makes it very clear that it was the matriarchal lines and it was a Baptist teacher down here that wrote maybe the best book on the subject, the black matriarch and the mongoloid matriarch and the red matriarch and the white matriarch that brought the diversity into the family following the flood. God did bless Shem and curse Ham, but God takes care of all those diversities by making us new creatures in Christ Jesus, members of the Christ race, with new life in us because of our faith. And the ultimate cure for racism is the new birth experience, where we are neither red, black, white, green, yellow, purple, black, brown, purple. By the red blood of Jesus, we've been cleansed, and we have new life, the Christ life in us, that makes us like Him when it's allowed to grow in full fruit. I'd like to continue on that subject too, but you got to get on the telephone and get the work done. Los Angeles, Dr. Scott, on June 30th, 1947, I saw a UFO in the Los Angeles area. It was traveling west to east and was about 4 to 5 blocks away from me. At first, I thought it was a comet or rocket, but looking at it closely told me it couldn't be. I told Griffith Observatory and the police, but they laughed at me. My own wife thought I was crazy. I've tried to talk to people about this, but it's impossible. Trust me, I'm not crazy. I have a photographic memory. I'm 74 years old now and still remember it vividly. I've tried to contact the author of that latest Roswell book, but have not been successful. Thanks for bringing up this subject, plus some other things. Los Alamos, do you think that beings on UFOs are created one way or the other? Albany, New York is listening to 1610, and Amherst, Massachusetts, listening to 1610 as I continue to get the report. Were their bodies recovered in New Mexico? Some of you didn't think I'd get to this. Marcel, remember him, Major Jesse Marcel, promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. Marcel was quite certain that no bodies were among the debris, and that whatever the object was, it must have exploded above ground level. But the evidence suggests that there was another crash site in an area west of Socorro, New Mexico, known as the Plains of San Agustin, where witnesses discovered not only a damaged metallic aircraft resting on the flat desert ground, but also dead bodies. The first witness on the scene was Grady L. Barney Barnett, a civil engineer with the U.S. Soil Conservation Service, who was on a military assignment at the time. I'm reading from above top secret, the worldwide UFO cover-up by Timothy Good. The first witness on the scene was Grady L. Barney Barnett, a civil engineer with the U.S. Soil Conservation Service who was on a military assignment at the time. He told some friends that in early July 1947 he had encountered a metallic disc-shaped aircraft about 25 or 30 feet in diameter. While he was examining it, a small group of people arrived who said they were part of an archaeological research team from the University of Pennsylvania, Barnett recalled. Quote, I noticed, he said, that they were standing around looking at some dead bodies that had fallen to the ground. I think there were others in the machine, which was a kind of metallic disc. It was not all that big. It seemed to be made of a metal that looked like dirty stainless steel. The machine had been split open by explosion or impact. I tried to get close to see what the bodies were like. They were all dead as far as I could see, and there were bodies inside and outside the vehicle. The ones outside had been tossed out by the impact. They were like humans, but they were not humans. Their heads were round, the eyes were small, and they had no hair. The eyes were oddly spaced. They were quite small by our standards, and their heads were larger in proportion to their bodies than ours. Their clothing seemed to be one piece and gray in color. You couldn't see any zippers, belts, or buttons. They seemed to me to be all males, and there were a number of them. I was close enough to touch them, but I didn't. I was escorted away before I could do so. While we were looking at them, a military officer drove up in a truck with a driver and took control. He told everybody that the Army was taking over and to get out of the way. Other military personnel came up and cordoned off the area. We were told to leave the area and not to talk to anyone whatever about what we had seen, that it was our patriotic duty to remain silent. Regrettably, this account cannot be regarded as reliable since it was related to friends of the witness in 1950. Barnett died in 1969, and the authors of the Roswell incident, a book which examines the evidence then available, were therefore unable to interview him. But those who knew Barney Barnett described him as the very model of a respectable and honest citizen, hardly likely to invent such a fantastic tale. Members of the University of Pennsylvania team have yet to come forward or be located, although William Moore has established that the university was involved in archaeological digs in the area at that time. It is not known for certain if the craft and occupants allegedly witnessed by Barnett were connected with the Roswell wreckage. The plains of San Agustin near Magdaleno, New Mexico, are about 150 miles west of Brazel's ranch site. Was the wreckage recovered there part of the same craft that had somehow managed to remain airborne for that distance before crashing on the plains, or was it another craft that had also come to grief? We may never know the full story, but Bill Moore, in one of his updated research papers on the Roswell incident, concludes that while there is insufficient evidence to substantiate Barnett's story or to justify linking it with the proven recovery of anomalous wreckage at Brazil's ranch site, there is no reason to dismiss the account out of hand. There is also the intriguing hypothesis that the first press release announcing the recovery of a crashed disc was a counterintelligence ploy to deflect attention from the craft and bodies near Magdalena. If so, It worked. Leading researchers Bill Moore and Stanton Friedman, the latter a nuclear physicist as well as a UFO researcher, have interviewed no less than 92 witnesses who provided information about this sensational incident, of whom 30 were involved with the discovery, with the recovery, or subsequent official cover-up, and 10 of the original witnesses have identified the object as non-terrestrial in origin. The book UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald R. Smith was written after Above Top Secret. It goes into a little more detail on the subject, unless you're bored. No government secrets seem safe these days, reading now about the middle of the book. And the Roswell crash is no exception. Until Major Jesse Marcel confided in Stanton Friedman, reference in the other article as a noted physicist as well as UFO analyst. Until Major Jesse Marcel confided in Stanton Friedman and decided to reveal his role in the event, most UFOlogists had put little credence in the stories of the crash retrievals of UFOs, with the exception of Friedman and Lynn Stringfield. Marcel's story was so convincing, and he was such a compelling witness, that several researchers decided that the Roswell case deserved further attention. Interest among researchers increased greatly in the 1980s, and the crash was discussed in both the print and broadcast media with some frequency. This was how matters stood in the fall of 1988 when CUFOS became involved in the investigation, an acronym CUFOS. Donald R. Smith, CUFO's director of special investigations, learned, contrary to everyone's understanding, the investigation of the Roswell event was incomplete. I'm doing this deliberately because we're on Channel 2 in New Mexico, and I keep hoping there'll be people listening that know things they haven't been free to speak about that will call in. Donald R. Smith, CUFO's director of special investigations, I repeat, learned, contrary to everyone's understanding, the investigation of the Roswell event was incomplete. This startling information came to CUFO's attention at a fortuitous moment. A CUFO's associate in Chicago interested in government involvement in UFO investigation had been studying the details of the Roswell crash as publicized or published and broadcast. He found inconsistencies in the timeline of events, puzzling omissions, and seemingly odd behavior on the part of the military. It was clear that additional investigation was necessary. Smith's report that more witnesses were available came as welcome news. Also in the fall of 1988, Smith began working closely with Kevin D. Randall, a former helicopter pilot and Air Force intelligence officer. Both were initially skeptical, but were convinced that something unusual had happened near Roswell. As the CUFOs Center for UFO Studies, CUFOS. As the CUFOS investigation proceeded, two shortcomings in the prior investigation of Roswell became quickly evident. The first was that many of the primary witnesses had not been interviewed systematically or in depth. The second was that the actual site of the crash had not been studied. CUFO's plan to remedy both these problems. It was at the end of 1988 that Smith and Randall planned their first trip to New Mexico. Smith knew a New Mexico contact had to be arranged and selected Don Mitchell of Santa Fe. Mitchell would be able to arrange some of the local interviews and provide advice on the operation in New Mexico. During the trip, interviews with the principals would tell them if the case was worth pursuing. One of the first witnesses contacted was Bill Brazel. What are you going to do on Friday night besides listen to this? He was reluctant to talk because of the number of people who had questioned him in the past. Meetings with Frank Joyce, the Proctors, and others were also arranged, names you'll remember from the previous reading in this book. Upon arriving in Albuquerque, Smith and Randall met with Mitchell. Mitchell had talked to Joyce, who had interviewed Mac Brazel before Brazel had surrendered his pieces of the craft to the Army and had then led the military to the crash site. Plans to meet with Joyce had to be postponed. Joyce was ill. And with the interview canceled, the only thing to do was to make the 200-mile trip from Albuquerque to the Roswell area. From there, they had to drive to Carrizozo to meet Bill Brazel. The first thing Bill Brazel said to them was, quote, "I've thought about this and thought about it, and I don't really know what I could tell you guys. My dad found this thing," he said, "and told me a little bit about it, not much, because the Air Force asked him to take an oath that he wouldn't tell anybody in detail about it, and my dad was such a guy that he went to his grave and he never told anybody. I found," Bill Brazel still talking, "a few bits and pieces later on. And the Air Force came out, they didn't confiscate it, they just put it to me in such a way that I should give it to them, or they would have. And I had no use for them. Dad had told me that he had taken an oath that he wouldn't tell in detail anybody. He told me I didn't need to know, and probably I'm better off." Brazel talked about his father finding the material and what he did after he had made the discovery. Quote, "He went out there and he loaded it all up onto his truck. He took it into the headquarters of the ranch. He had a Jeep pickup, and it completely filled all that he could get on this Jeep pickup. And he picked it up and hauled it in. Now, he very likely did, though I don't know, when he got into headquarters, he might have took it all and pushed it under a shed. Very likely he did that to get it out of the pickup because he used his pickup. Later on, then, he went to Roswell. He didn't haul it down there because the Army or the Air Force came up and picked it up. They picked it up in a station wagon or a van that completely filled that, all they could carry. That was Major Marcel, and the CIC man," said Smith. "Yeah. Major Marcel, and I never met the man, but that name is, yeah, he's the man who talked to my dad." "How soon after the incident were you able to go to the ranch itself?" asked Smith. "I got up one morning and was living in Albuquerque at the time. I got the paper and I looked at it, and here's my dad's picture." Actually, the newspaper contained only a story about Mac Brazel and no picture. "I said to Shirley Brazel, 'What the hell did he do now?' So I proceeded out to the ranch. I think it was 2 or 3 days before my dad showed up, and I said, 'What'd you get into?' And he said, 'Oh, I found the thing out there.' The worldwide press was after him. I said, 'It looks like you're rich and famous, or famous anyway.' I said, 'I'll stay here and take care of the ranch,' but nothing happened, so I went back to Albuquerque to my own business. You asked me a question, and that's the first time I thought about it. I know he hauled it into the ranch, and we had some sheds there, and he backed the pickup to it and pushed all the stuff off it. We've heard that a number of neighbors were involved in some fashion," Randall said. "You're not aware of anyone like that at all?" Bill Brazel. Probably he told them that he found a bunch of stuff. Now, Floyd Proctor might have come down. He might have. There might have been more than that who came out and looked at the stuff. And Dad just didn't say anything about it. By the time I talked to him, the Air Force or the Army had already had him, and he just wouldn't tell me very much about it. I'd ask him a question, and he told me a little about it, naturally, but if I asked him very many questions, he'd just say, well, I told them I wouldn't tell, and you don't need to know. That's the way he was. Smith, did your father seem different after he came home? No way. That he knew something that he still couldn't talk about? Said Smith, my dad knew a lot of things that he wouldn't talk about. He might know who stole the calf, but I don't know how to put it across to you people. He was an old-time Western cowboy. He didn't do a lot of talking. His philosophy in life was, if you can't say anything good about a person, don't say anything. It's been kind of hard for me to explain this to all the people who call me about this thing. I say, one lady, a newspaper reporter from El Paso, and she said, you mean your own father didn't tell you, she said? Didn't you ask him? I said, yes, ma'am, I did ask him. But he had given his word to the Air Force that he wouldn't tell about it in detail, and I said, no, he didn't tell me. She said, I don't believe that. Then why'd you call me? I told her he took an oath not to tell, and he didn't. Did you find many pieces, Randall said? I imagine, not over a dozen, I'd say eight. Just different little pieces. There was only three items involved, something on the order of balsa wood, something on the order of heavy-gauge monofilament fishing line, a little piece of... It wasn't really aluminum foil, and it wasn't really lead foil, but it was on that order. One piece, about the size of my fingers, with jagged edges. After the Air Force came, did you ever go out there and look for anything else? Asked Smith. Oh, yes. Every time I was out there, I looked. Did you ever find anything? Nope. I never did find anything else. Riding horseback, you see far better than you can even walking. Walking, you got to watch where you put your feet. Riding a horse, you can really look. Well, naturally, I was curious. This thing made quite a track down through there. It took a year or two for it to grass back over and heal up. Then I rode up there probably on an average of once a week. When I was riding through that area, hell, I was looking. That's why I found these little pieces. I never really did go looking for anything. I didn't figure it was worth it anyway. But just curiosity. And I'd see something that didn't belong there, and I'd get off and stick it in my chap's pocket. I might keep it there for a week before I'd reach in there and see what it was. Did your father know you were collecting the pieces? Asked Smith. Oh, yeah. I showed it to him. He said, oh, yeah, that's some of the thing, that thing I found. But he didn't tell you to be quiet about it, said Smith. What the hell good is a little old scrap? A little piece of garbage. I was in Corona in the bar in the pool hall that was kind of a meeting place for that little town. That's where everybody got together when they went to town. Everybody was asking me. They'd all seen the papers, and they were all asking me about it. I said I'd picked up a few old bits and pieces and fragments. Well, what are they? I said, hell, I don't know. And lo and behold, here comes the military. In uniform? Asked Randall. Yep. I'm still not really sure, but I'm almost positive that the officer in charge, his name was Armstrong. A real nice guy. Now, he had a sergeant with him that was real nice. I think there were two other enlisted men. They came out to the ranch, and they were talking to me, and they said, we understand your father found this weather balloon. And I said, yeah. They said, we understand you found some bits and pieces of it. I've got a cigar box that's got a few in there. And this, I think, he was a captain, as best I can remember, said, well, we'd like to take it with us. I said, well. He smiled and he said, your father turned the rest of it over to us. You know, he's under an oath not to tell anyone. I said, who knows better than I do? Well, he said, we came after those bits and pieces. I kind of smiled and I said, it's kind of like when I was in the Navy. We want volunteers. We want you, you and you. I said, okay, you can have the stuff. I have no use for it. He said, how well have you examined it? I said, well enough to know that I don't know what it is. He said, we'd rather that you wouldn't talk much about it. And I really didn't. After that, people would ask me, and I'd just say, well, did you ever see any of the neighbors out in the field? Asked Smith. Not anybody, said Brazell. As far as I know, the only people who've been out there and looked was the Army or the Air Force, whichever it was. I think they did come out there with quite a few troops. And they walked and really kind of combed the area. But as far as anyone else going out there, Floyd Proctor might have, but to my knowledge, he didn't find anything. Was your father the only one you ever showed the pieces you found, said Smith? Yeah. He looked at it and said, yeah, that looks like some of the contraption I found. Actually, this was before monofilament fishing line was a popular item. That's the nearest I could compare it to. Now, there's this plastic fiber optics. It could have been that. But it was about like the heavy gauge nylon fishing line. That's the closest comparison as I can give you. And there were some pieces of wood. I had several of those. Real wood or like wood, asked Smith. No, they were like wood. Well, they were like balsa wood, real light, kind of neutral color, kind of tan. I couldn't break it. Would it bend at all? Randall asked. Flex a little. Longest piece I found, about 6 inches, would flex a little. I couldn't break it, and I couldn't whittle it with my pocket knife. The only reason I noticed the tinfoil was that I picked this stuff up and put it in my chaps pocket. Like I said, I had it in there 2-3 days, and when I took it out and put it in the box, I happened to notice that when I put that piece of foil in the box, it started unfolding and flattened out. Then I got to playing with it. I would fold it or crease it and lay it down and watch it. It's kind of weird. Other than that, that's the three items I found. Piece of this balsa wood, some of that string, some of that foil. Were the edges straight, asked Smith? No. The piece I found was a jagged piece. I couldn't tear it. Hell, tin foil or lead foil is easy, but I couldn't tear it. I didn't take pliers or anything. I just used my fingers. I didn't try to cut it with my knife, but I did try to whittle on that piece of wood. I didn't even get a little sliver off of it. Any color variations? The color was consistent throughout the pieces I found. It was a dull color. Want to hear any more?
Yes,
go on telephone. Well, Rancho Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Doc. You want a jumping horse show at our show? My barn is right across from yours, usually at the shows. And it ain't a real horse show if you don't show up. I remember that. You're fun to watch. You really got something to say. I'll see you at the next show. Barn across from yours. I'll look for you. Because we'll be there. North Hollywood, between the UFOs and the pyramids, do you have any opinion on Zachariah Sitkin's book? Yeah, I do. I think Zachariah Sitkin is the most well-informed researcher since Velikovsky. I don't agree with all of his conclusions. The evidence he offers for his conclusions, overwhelming. I can draw some different conclusions from the same evidence, but the evidence is overwhelming. And he may be right about that planet that you better look out for. I like Sitka. I'm reading from UFO Crash at Roswell. Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. They're interviewing in 1988 the son of the farmer who found the crash site. The thing about the interview was Brazell had confirmed everything that Smith and Randall had ever heard about him or about him. From him or about him. There were a few minor discrepancies in his stories. Little changes that were explainable by the time between his telling of the stories. These little changes suggested a story told from a memory of the events rather than a rehearsed story told to convince the gullible that something untrue had happened. Smith, upon returning from New Mexico, briefed the CUFO's board in Chicago. Impressed with the preliminary report, Mark Rodiger, the scientific director, initiated plans for the first scientific excavation at the crash site since 1947. 10 months of research went into substantiating the actual crash site that included 2 trips into Corona, New Mexico. Meetings were arranged with scientists Carl B. Breck and Sue Ann Curtis who worked for a major laboratory. Their effort would result in an expedition to New Mexico later, March 1989. Now we're getting closer to the present time. Both Smith and Randall realized shortly after the first trip to Roswell that there was much... Am I boring you? Much more to do. One witness had provided... I bet this book's bought out wherever it's sold. One witness had provided a lead to the mortician who prepared the bodies of the aliens for shipment. Bill Brazel had told them a little about Tommy Tyree and the Proctors. They knew that Walter Haupt, the PIO at Roswell in the summer of 1947, the information officer who released the first news release that had to be corrected, still lived in Roswell, and they had not been able to talk to Frank Joyce. These were all things that had to be done. Because there was work to do in Albuquerque as well, Randall arrived a day early on the next trip. One thing to do was to check out the newspaper files. Copies were needed of all the articles that ran in both Albuquerque newspapers, and finding the picture of Mac Brazel in the paper would tell them exactly what day Bill Brazel had read about it, and that would give them a time frame for his return to the ranch. As already noted, they pulled the papers. There's no picture of Mac Brazel. There was an article. July 10th. Next, Randall tried to track down the mortician. He found the man identified as the mortician easily, but that was the last of the good luck. The man denied that it was him. He had never been a mortician, had never lived in Roswell. He'd been to Roswell on vacation, but that's the best he could do. Someone had given Smith and Randall bad information. The first day in Albuquerque had not worked out. No picture of Mac Brazel in the paper for Bill to see, as he had indicated. But there was an article for him to read. And then the man identified as the mortician had not been involved. That was the most disappointing. The next day, both Smith and Randall were ready to interview Frank Joyce. This time, he had agreed to meet with them. Randall took out a tape recorder and asked if Joyce minded if the session was recorded. "I would rather you didn't," he said. Randall turned off the recorder, and Smith asked, "Do you mind if we make notes?" "Nope." The first thing Joyce did was show them a number of documents, letters, and a teletype message to establish his credentials. He had been working at a radio station, KGFL in Roswell, in the summer of 1947. He also unfolded a sheet of teletype paper that had a question on it from the AP headquarters. On July 7, 1947, in response to the information coming out of Roswell, it asked, quote, "Is this the same ranch where there was a hullabaloo last week?" Joyce had no explanation for that comment. Joyce went on to explain that he would call the office of Sheriff George A. Wilcox in the afternoon to see if there was anything of interest happening. According to Joyce, Wilcox was unimpressed with the story that Brazel was telling, but handed the phone to Brazel, telling Joyce, "Here's something that you might find interesting." Joyce claimed that Wilcox didn't believe the story and Brazel wasn't sure what to do. Joyce suggested that he call the air base because the military was involved with all things flying and the officers might know what Brazel had found. Joyce said that Brazel had told him everything on the phone, but when asked for clarification, Joyce responded, "W.W. is dead, and I don't want to put words in a dead man's mouth." He refused to answer questions about what Brazel found, only that Brazel was in the sheriff's office, and it was Joyce's idea that Brazel call the military. The next day, according to Joyce, Walter Haupt, the PIO from the base, arrived at the station with a press release. According to Joyce, Haupt told me, "I'm giving you an hour on this." After Haupt left. Joyce took it, read it over, and then called Houtright back. He said, Walder, you don't want to send this out like this. According to Joyce, there were procedural errors in it. Hout was making statements in the name of higher headquarters without permission to do it. Hout said that Colonel Blanchard had told him to release it. The release was issued, and Joyce claimed that a Colonel Johnson called him from the Pentagon screaming at him and demanding to know who the hell told him to issue the release. Joyce finally managed to convince Johnson that he was no longer in the Army and there was nothing Johnson could do about it. Johnson responded, I'll show you what I can do about it and what I can do to you. After he got the call, Joyce decided he better have some proof that he hadn't made up the story. He found the press release that Howard had given him. He showed it to the station owner, Walter Whitman Sr. According to Joyce, Brazell came to the radio station on July 9th. Brazell had a news story about his discovery that differed significantly from the one he had told before the military had interviewed him. According to Joyce, Brazell was under a great deal of stress and said it would go very hard on him if he didn't cooperate. During the second interview with Brazell, Joyce noticed there were several military officers waiting in the lobby of the station. They didn't say anything. They didn't accompany Brazell into the control room. As he was leaving, according to Joyce, Brazell turned and said, quote, you know how they talk about little green men? Well, they weren't green. With that, Brazell, with the military officers surrounding him, left the station. After that was all over, Joyce claimed that someone came to the station and cleared out every scrap of paper that had anything about the event on it. They found everything, including those duplicates that Joyce had tried to hide. Joyce claimed that Judd Dixon, the AP man in Santa Fe, reported the same thing. Someone was pulling the paper trail apart. Dixon's files on the Roswell event had vanished. Smith and Randall quizzed Joyce for another 20 or 30 minutes, but were now covering the same ground. Joyce didn't remember anything new. They thanked him and all left the hotel room. Joyce drove back to work. Smith and Randall left for Capitan, New Mexico, where they would meet Bill Brazell. Brazell had promised to take them out to the crash site. On the way there, they learned little about the events of July 1947, but more about the Brazell family. Brazell, to skip over that, Brazell now drove along county roads that were nothing more than plowed tracks through the ranges. Brazell said they periodically came out to plow the roads again, sometimes altering them, so that a road that led to one place 5 years earlier might no longer be there. Brazell turned off the road, used a smaller track across the prairie. There was a rutted road cut with the wheels of vehicles. It climbed a hill and disappeared. Now he drove cross country. There was no road to the crash site, just open ground where there were rattlesnakes, deer, sheep, and saddle. They came out of the side of the hill. In front of them was a shallow, narrow valley with a rounded, rocky area at one end. The other end opened gradually until it was nothing more than a pasture sloping down into another, bigger valley. The gouge started up there and moved down in that direction, said Brazell. He described the gouge as running from the northwest to the southwest. It looked as if the thing had hit, bounced, scattering debris in the field. The gouge wasn't very deep, but it was about 10 feet wide in places. The whole thing was about 500 feet long. Where'd you find the scraps? Asked Smith. Brazell pointed outside the truck and said, around here, all over here. But in March 1989, there was nothing to see. The gouge had grown over, according to Bill Brazell, within 2 years. The material, the lead foil, the balsa wood, or balsa-like wood, and the fiber optics had been cleaned with the military. There was nothing to mark the field as an extraordinary place. They returned to the pickup. Bill Brazell was sitting there waiting for them. Nothing to see, he said. They returned to Capitan. That afternoon, they arranged to meet Walter Haupt in Roswell. As the public information officer, he had been in the position to know a lot about what was happening on the base in July 1947. And it had been Haupt who had issued the famous statement saying that officers at the Roswell Army Airfield had captured a flying saucer. They met Walter Haupt at his home on Saturday afternoon. He invited them into his living room. He told them to go ahead and ask their questions. The first thing Walter said was that he could sum everything up that he knew in one word: nothing. Randall started the official interview. "You were, well, we all know you were the PIO out of Roswell when the thing came down." "Yes." Blanchard said Jesse Marcel had brought something in that looked like a flying disc or a flying saucer or parts thereof. Haupt said, "Put out a press release on this that it was discovered on a ranch outside of Roswell near Corona. Basically, that's all I'm going to tell you. Jesse's going to take it and fly it down to Fort Worth." "So he was scheduled to go to Fort Worth?" Randall asked. "Haupt, Marcel was going to put it in an aircraft and take it to Fort Worth. That's after they had looked at it and everything else. I didn't hear about it until I guess Jess was on his way to the flight line. That's about it. That's all I know. As I told you, I could tell you all this over the telephone." "So Blanchard called you," Randall said. "Told you we have one, put out your press release. You didn't ask him if you could see it. You just put out the press release. The next day the phone's been ringing off the hook and you said, 'Wow, am I famous or what?'" "I was famous enough that if you..." "This is all before your time. At one time, they had clipping services that would send you a postcard that would say your name appeared in such and such paper, and if you send us 50 cents, a dollar, whatever it was, we'll send you a copy of the paper. I had two stacks of postcards that tall," and he indicated a stack about 6 inches high, "from all over the world. I wasn't even smart enough to save the stamps." "Did Jesse Marcel ever tell you anything about it?" Smith asked. "Nope." "Did you ever see Mac Brazel?" "Nope." "You ever discuss it with Frank Joyce?" "Nope." "He call you after the press release before it went out over the wire and say you didn't want to say it that way?" Randall asked. "No." "Advising you this was a mistake?" said Smith. "No." He hesitated and then said, "I hate to be this way, but you're asking me pointed questions. Did you see Marcel after he came back from Fort Worth?" asked Smith. "Yeah. As a matter of fact, you see him quite regularly. He lived right down the block here, one block." "Right after he returned?" "No." "I think the most interesting part of this whole thing, you can verify this by going down to the newspaper office and looking at the newspapers, is the time frame. For 2 days it was front page and then it disappeared. The thing died extremely fast." "Especially after Fort Worth with Brigadier General Ramey," said Smith. "Why do you think that Blanchard was so quick to order you to make the report?" "You'd have to have known the man. Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it. He had a very sincere interest in the relationship between the base and the community. If anything unusual or anything he felt the community should know about, he'd call me up and say, 'Get this out.' He did it with many things. If he thought of a thing like when you take releases into town, don't stop at the first one and give it to them every time. That was the morning dispatch on Main Street. And there was KGFL and KSWS and then the record. He wanted them alternated so that no one could say that we were showing partiality. But basically, I rarely questioned him on anything. Looking back on this from the perspective of 42 years, what do you think they found?" asked Randall. "A bunch of stuff that Jess Marcel took to Fort Worth. I think actually they found something that they actually..." And I've got to base what I'm saying, going to say on what Jess Marcel told me. "It was something that he had never seen and didn't believe that it was of this planet. I trusted him on his knowledge. He felt that it was something that was not made or mined or built or manufactured anywhere on this planet. He was explaining things to me, a little thin, paper-thin piece of foil that you couldn't burn and you couldn't bend and you couldn't cut. He explained a whole bunch of this stuff to me. At the time, we thought, 'Oh, Christ, weather balloon, that's good.'" "Everybody accepted it as a weather balloon," said Smith. As a matter of fact, I guess it was a rumor they started about how dumb we were. The fact that it was released from here on the base, that there was a detachment that came over from Holloman Air Force Base and released the balloon here to pick up the winds going in the direction. Were you aware at the time of recovery effort itself? No, I was not. So there was no activity on the base which indicated that? Not that was known to the average people. Carry this one step further. Was never mentioned in the staff meeting, and I used to sit in all staff meetings. Was that unusual? Oh, someone would have heard it from someone. Apparently the thing was bottled up when they found out actually what it was. So as far as staff meetings go, there was no mention of the detachment of the detainment of Mac Brazel at the base, questioning him, Smith said. Oh, we heard there was. I think I heard it from some of the other news media about Walt Whitmore, that they had practically kidnapped him. Walt was an old-time newsman. You never could quite tell whether everything he said was truth all the time. So you didn't hear that Brazel had been held incommunicado on the base for a while, Randall said? Nope. Not on the base. In town, yes. In Whitmore's home? Well, in town. I think the rumor was that Walt was moving him from place to place. This was it's a much more interesting story when you move a man from place to place. And the military's hot on his heels? Brazel was apparently kept in Roswell for 5 or 6 days, Randall said, with military authorities, but you're saying he wasn't kept on the base? To my knowledge, I did not know he had been on the base. Hout was quiet for a moment and said, I'm like my wife. I think there was one gigantic cover-up on the thing. I think that somewhere all this material is stashed away. The only thing I cannot comprehend is how, with all the people, and I start talking about people, I know that Jess Marcel did not go out to that airplane and fly it alone. He had to have a co-pilot and a crew. I don't think there was a one of those crew members who would have strained themselves to load this on an airplane. The truck drivers, people that, the maintenance people, and when it gets to Fort Worth, there are more people involved, and at Wright Field, there are more people there. And all this time, no one has stolen a piece, said Hout. Jess Marcel, this I can understand. He was not the kind who would. But, Randall said, you think there was some kind of cover-up. I think there was a giant cover-up, said Walter Hout. Can't read all this to you. You have to go buy the book. Be here till Jesus comes sometime in the next decade, if he comes then. Oh, Jesse Marcel. He's the one that can tell us something. With everything in place, Schmidt and Randall left for Montana. When they arrived in Missoula, they met with Watkins. Watkins made it clear he'd spent years as a psychologist, author of 6 books, over 90 papers, and more than 100 articles on various aspects of his research. From Missoula, they drove to Jesse Marcel's home. While Watkins talked to Jesse Marcel, Smith and Randall interviewed his mother. They wanted to learn what her impressions were when Major Marcel brought home some of the material recovered on the crash site. She said that Jesse Sr. was excited about it. He thought it was something extraordinary, and of course she didn't know what it could be. They'd spread it out in the kitchen to examine it. Her description of it matched those given to the others who had handled it. The afternoon session with Jesse Marcel himself produced the best results. And that's where we'll leave off for a while you get on telephone.